The second Tuesday, we talk about feeling sorry for yourself. I came back the next Tuesday, and for many Tuesdays that followed. I looked forward to these visits more than one would think, considering I was flying 700 miles to sit alongside a dying man. But I seemed to slip into a time warp when I visited Maury, and I liked myself better when I was there. I no longer rented a cellular phone for the rides from the airport. Let them wait, I told myself, mimicking Maury. The newspaper situation in Detroit had not improved. In fact, it had grown increasingly insane, with nasty confrontations between picketers and replacement workers, people arrested, beaten, lying in the street in front of delivery trucks. In light of all this, my visits with Maury felt like a cleansing rinse of human kindness. We talked about life, we talked about love, we talked about one of Maury's favorite subjects, compassion, and why our society had such a shortage of it. Before my third visit, I stopped at a market called Bread and Circus. I'd seen their bags in Maury's house, and I figured he must like the food there, so I loaded up with plastic containers from their fresh food takeaway, things like vermicelli with vegetables and carrot soup and baklava. When I entered Maury's study, I lifted the bags as if I'd just robbed a bank. "Food man," I bellowed. Maury rolled his eyes and smiled. Meanwhile, I looked for signs of the disease's progression. His fingers worked well enough to write with a pencil or hold up his glasses, but he could not lift his arms much higher than his chest. He was spending less and less time in the kitchen or living room and more in the study, where he had a large reclining chair set up with pillows, blankets, and specially cut pieces of foam rubber that held his feet and gave support to his withered legs. He kept a bell near his side, and when his head needed adjusting, or he had to go on the commode, as he referred to it, he would shake the bell, and his small army of home care workers would come in. It wasn't always easy for him to lift the bell, and he got frustrated when he couldn't make it work. I asked Maury if he felt sorry for himself. "Sometimes, in the morning," he said, "that's when I mourn. I feel around my body, I move my fingers and my hands, whatever I can still move, and I mourn what I've lost. I mourn the slow, insidious way in which I'm dying. But then I stop mourning." "Just like that," I said. "I give myself a good cry if I need it. But then I concentrate on all the good things still in my life, on the people who are coming to see me, on the stories I'm going to hear, on you, if it's Tuesday, because we're Tuesday people." I grinned, "Tuesday people." "Mitch," Maury said, "I don't allow myself any more self-pity than that. A little each morning, a few tears, and that's all." I thought about all the people I knew who spent many of their waking hours feeling sorry for themselves. How useful it would be to put a daily limit on self-pity. Just a few tearful minutes, then on with the day. And if Maury could do it with such a horrible disease, well. Maury said, "It's only horrible if you see it that way, Mitch. It's horrible to watch my body slowly wilt away to nothing. But it's also wonderful because of all the time I get to say goodbye." He smiled. "Not everyone is so lucky." I studied him in his chair, unable to stand, to wash, to pull on his pants. Lucky, I thought. Did he really say lucky? During a break when Maury had to use the bathroom, I leafed through the Boston newspaper that sat near his chair. There was a story about a small timber town where two teenage girls tortured and killed the 73-year-old man who'd befriended them, then threw a party in his trailer home and showed off the corpse. There was another story about the upcoming trial of a straight man who killed a gay man after the latter had gone on a TV talk show and said he had a crush on him. I put the paper away. Maury was rolled back in, smiling as always, and Connie went to lift him from the wheelchair to the recliner. "You want me to do that?" I asked. There was a momentary silence, and I'm not even sure why I offered, but Maury looked at Connie and said, "Can you show him how to do it?" "Sure," Connie said. Following her instructions, I leaned over, locked my forearms under Maury's armpits, and hooked him towards me, as if lifting a large log from underneath. Then I straightened up, hoisting him as I rose. Now, normally when you lift someone, you expect their arms to tighten around your grip. But Maury could not do this. He was mostly dead weight, and I felt his head bounce softly on my shoulder and his body sag against me like a big damp loaf. "Ah," he softly groaned. I gotcha, I said. Holding him like that moved me in a way I cannot describe, except to say I felt the seeds of death inside his shriveling frame. And as I laid him in his chair, adjusting his head on the pillows, I had the coldest realization that our time was running out, and I had to do something.